night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Rabbana,
ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very interesting question, and that's something that all of us, no matter who we are concerned with this problem, especially those people who work in business and commerce. As you know, Islam is a complete religion. It has rules and regulations for all aspects of life, from the way we eat and drink, the way we use the bathroom, all the way up to how we should rule a country and a government. And in this respect, Islam is very unique. You know, not all religions are like this. And this is something, this is one of the, distinctions of the Islamic faith. So the question we want to pose today is this: what are the etiquettes of trading and commerce in Islam? We can take inspiration for the answer to this question from some of the verses of the Holy Quran and also the Hadith. In one verse of the Holy Quran, we read the following: O you who have faith, do not eat up your wealth among yourselves unrightfully, but it should be trade by mutual consent. And do not kill yourselves. Indeed, Allah is most merciful to you. And in this connection, regarding the etiquettes of trading, we have many beautiful hadiths which allude to some of them. Some of these hadiths allude to some etiquettes, some of them allude to others. If we put them all together, we can have a comprehensive understanding of what are the etiquettes of trading within Islam. For example, in one prophetic hadith, it's been mentioned that the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam said the following: whoever sells or buys must avoid five habits, or he should not sell or buy at all. And the Prophet, then he enumerated those five habits. The first is usury or riba. The second is false oaths. Meaning, for example, if you're selling something, you swear and make a false oath that, you know, the commodity that you're selling is, you know, is very good, it's better than it actually is, and these kind of things. The third is hiding the defects of merchandise. You know, if the merchandise has some problem, that it's wrong, it has these defects, hiding it from the people is to make a quick buck from them. Then the fourth is praising what the person sells, like overly embellishing the product, praising it more than it really deserves. You know, these are other problems, that should be avoided when conducting commerce. And finally, the Prophet says, showing disapproval for what he intends to buy. Maybe probably what it means is that if somebody wants to buy something, first showing that he doesn't like it, so perhaps like bringing down the price, maybe this could be an allusion to this, or it might be something else. In general, we know that, you know, merchants or people who are traders, they should know the laws of Islam before they conduct, you know, trade. In this connection, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, O merchants, knowledge of trading laws first, then trade itself. Ya ma'sharat tujjar al-fiqhu summa al-matjar. And then the Imam repeated this three times. knowledge first, then trade, knowledge first, then trade, right? So having this knowledge of these rules of Islam is important for all of people who want to take part in this. Thank you for joining us here in The Key. We were looking at the etiquettes of trading in Islam in the light of the Quranic verses and prophetic hadith. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
On June 20th, 2023, Albanian police raided a camp belonging to the anti-Iran terrorist Mujahideen Khalq organization, the MKO, on charges of terror and cyber attacks against foreign institutions. Shortly after, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Nasser Kanani tweeted, "Due to their terrorist nature, the MKO will always be a danger to the security of its host country," adding, "This is why the Iraqi government expelled them and other governments refused to accept them. We hope the Albanian government makes up for its mistake in hosting this terrorist cult. The fact is, as a bloodthirsty group, the MKO is no stranger to terrorist attacks on foreign soil, and its dark track record in Iraq is just a case in point." Before moving to Albania in the mid-2010s, the MKO had lived in Camp Ashraf in northeast Baghdad, Iraq, for more than two decades under the aegis of the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. And before that, the organization had carried out numerous terrorist attacks against Iranian officials and civilians, drawing some 17,000 people to the jaws of death. In fact, the MKO's long list of crimes against their own compatriots made the group a trustworthy partner to Saddam Hussein, who was in an all-out war with Iran. In June 1987, that's less than a year after the MKO established its base in Ashraf, its leader, Masoud Rajavi, announced the establishment of its army at the service of his Iraqi godfather. As native Farsi speakers, members of the MKO army could easily infiltrate Iran's military forces, gathering intelligence on the front line for the Iraqi regime. The army also carried out tens of military operations against Iran. But the MKO mission didn't come to an end after Iran accepted UN Security Council Resolution 598, which called for an immediate ceasefire. In fact, Saddam Hussein evinced even more interest in the group that had shown no mercy to its compatriots. It could serve as his private army in troubled times. The Iraqi dictator then equipped the MKO with an array of modern tanks, personnel carriers, and even helicopters, and trained its members under the supervision of Iraqi seasoned commanders. Up until the year 1988, Iranian civilians were almost the MKO's sole victims. But gradually, Iraqi citizens, including Iraqi Shias and Kurds, also fell victim to the organization's heinous crimes. On August 2, 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded neighboring Kuwait, seeking to compensate for heavy losses he had incurred in his 8-year-old war on Iran. But the Iraqi dictator had made some miscalculations. All his erstwhile Western and Arab supporters stood up against him. So he experienced a second humiliating defeat within a period of a decade, this time in a war called the First Persian Gulf War. The perception that Saddam Hussein had become vulnerable to regime change triggered widespread uprisings against him that lasted from March to April 1991. Initial protests turned into widespread uprisings in which both Shia and Sunni Muslims stood side by side against the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. Just a few days after the start of the uprising in the south, which is also referred to as the Shabaniya Intifada, due to its concurrence with the month of Shaban, another wave of insurgency broke out in the Kurdish-populated areas in the north. Against such a backdrop, the army and intelligence services proved ineffectual in the face of nationwide uprisings, and the dictator was in danger of collapse. But one thing changed the course of history to the detriment of the Iraqi people: the MKO army. The fall of Saddam Hussein meant the fall of Rajavi and his cult. So he deployed his task forces to Basra to infiltrate the protesters in order to identify the leaders of the uprisings. Because there were Iranian nationals, no one suspected them to be the regime's agents. The MKO members accomplished their mission, and within a short period of time, the leaders of the uprisings were all arrested and sentenced to death. Many more went missing for years. Their tragic fate came to light after the fall of Saddam Hussein and the discovery of mass graves. The MKO also helped the Ba'ath regime suppress Iraqi Kurds. Following Saddam Hussein's defeat in the First Persian Gulf War, Kurdish fighters took over Kurdish-populated cities in the north. In addition, they brought under control some areas in western Iraq. While the regime's ragtag army was busy with the uprisings in the south, the time was ripe for the Kurdish fighters in the north to go to Baghdad and topple Saddam Hussein. But here again, the MKO came to save the Iraqi dictator through blocking the Kurds' way to the capital until the arrival of the Iraqi reinforcements. According to the New York Times, Maryam, Masoud Rajavi's wife, told her fighters, "Take the Kurds under your tanks and save your bullets for the Iranian Revolutionary Guards," meaning the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. With the MKO's vital support, Saddam Hussein remained in power for more than 12 years, and with the group's help, thousands of Iraqi Kurds were killed in a bloodbath that later came to be known as the Anfal Genocide.
There are over 1,500 people buried here. They are mostly women and children. There are just 5 men. All others are women and children. They are Kurds from Kurdistan. We believe they are victims of Anfal campaigns in 1988, that Saddam Hussein's regime committed genocide crime against the people of Kurdistan.
The mass killing of the Kurds in the north resulted in the displacement of hundreds of thousands of Kurdish families. Many Kurdish women and children lost their lives to the cold and hunger, while many went missing. After the fall of Saddam Hussein in 2003, Iraqi prisons were the only hope for the families to find their missing loved ones. But as was with the case of Iraqi Shias, mass graves found in prison yards dashed their hopes forever. In 2003, the Iraqi people saw the long-awaited day when the senile dictator was finally arrested, put on trial, and sentenced to death. But as the main accomplice to Saddam Hussein's inhumane crimes, the MKO has so far avoided trial. Ironically, in recent years, the group has made democracy and human rights its new mantra, a desperate attempt to hide its ugly past. The raid by Albanian police came a few days after France banned an upcoming MKO rally in Paris. Has the West come to its senses? And will it stop harboring the terrorist group on its soil? History shows that the MKO is not like a gentle, caring guest, but a cannibal who can feast voraciously upon the flesh of the host with no remorse.
We try to get close to whom Imam al-Hussein actually is.
Verily, in the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, there is a warmth in the hearts of the believers that will never cool off.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam sees that the evil system is starting to institutionalize itself.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Ya tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein. Ya Habibi, Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
Imam Zain al-Abidin, there are a number of things that he does. One of them is that he wrote letters. Imam Zain al-Abidin has given us these jewels, brothers and sisters, in shaping the identity of Shia. We have got to try doing that amongst the Shia. I read something the other day, an account in history that I had not come across. It's actually related to Imam Zain al-Abidin's time as well. And it's very scary, very frightening, very frightening. The account that says that irtaddad nas, people turned away from the Imam, true Islam, after Ashura, after Karbala. It says that one of the companions of the fourth Imam said this. And when he was saying this to some of the Shia in Medina, you know what he said to the Shia in Medina? This is a Shia, they're a Shia. But they are by name. This is a real Shia. He used the words, the phrases of Ibrahim against the kuffar of his tribe. Inna bura'a'u minkum wa bada baynana wa baynakum al-adawatu wal-baghdha hatta tu'minu billahi wahdah. The words, we've gone over them in tafsir of Surah Mumtahana. Words of Ibrahim to the kuffar, he said, Inna bura'a'u minkum, we have nothing to do with you. Bada baynana wa baynakum al-adawatu wal-baghdha. There's enmity and hatred between us. Not personally. As long as you're on that path, there's hatred and enmity. حَتَّى تُؤْمِنُوا بِاللَّهِ وَحْدًا. Until you believe in the one God. Those are the words of Ibrahim towards the kuffar. This Shia of Imam Zain al-Abidin is referring to the Shia, the so-called Shia of the Ahlul Bayt. Those who consider themselves the Shia of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the Shia of Imam al-Mujtaba. They consider themselves that. He says to them this line, very scary, frightening. It could come to a time where the identity of someone who calls themselves a Shia, their very identity, there's a time where the identity hasn't changed. I have shortcomings. I don't do everything I know is right, but the identity and my understanding is straight. I don't approve of wrongdoing, but I'm involved with it on a small scale. I know I'm trying to get rid of this. These are two different things. The identity changes. For some of us, the identity has changed. We need What Imam Zain al-Abidin did at the time for us, we need the Shia to read these lines, repeat them weekly. Because the identity of some of us is please the authorities, not the authorities of the fusaq or the munafiqeen. The authority of blatant kufr, the authority of Trump, the authority of the Queen of England, the authority of the German ruling class and authority. You need to please them, keep them happy. This goes against the identity of the Shia. If that is your identity, bada baynana wa baynakum al-adawatu wal-baghdha hatta tu'minu billahi wahda. This is what we learn from Imam Zain al-Abidin and what he's trying to do. If your identity, you call yourself a Shia, and this is what you think tashayyu' is, this is what you call taqiyya, in the name of taqiyya, you're going against the identity of tashayyu' that Imam Zain al-Abidin said, bada baynana wa baynakum al-adawatu wal-baghdha. The relation between me and you is, no, I'm not with you. Whatever you call yourself, you should remove that name. That's not the identity of tashayyu'. If any speaker encourages this type of behavior, they are encouraging the identity of Taghut, the identity of the Umayyads, the identity of the time that Imam Zain al-Abidin was going against. And we should say the same thing to them. Bada baynana wa baynakum al-adawatu wal-baghdha. You're changing the identity of tashayyu'. How dare you call yourself something else? Tashayyu' is this. Tashayyu' is Imam Zain al-Abidin in the court of Yazid, standing against Yazid, where he's brought in chains at their disposal. They could do anything to him. They've already beheaded his father. The head of his Imam al-Hussein is sitting there. Imam Zain al-Abidin is in chains. This is tashayyu'. These are the leaders of tashayyu'. This is being Shia. This is the identity. Imam Zain al-Abidin trains. Said, look, this is what you need to do. Don't worry what they're going to do to you. Taking away your comforts or not giving you comforts, taking away your freedoms or whatever they want to do, that should not be a reason for you to behave one way or another. You should be looking at what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says. Look at what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says. Please Allah, and do not choose the dunya. This is the zuhd of Ali ibn Abi Talib and the zuhd of Imam Zain al-Abidin. Razaqanallahu wa iyyakum. Ya Aba Muhammad, Ya Zain al-Abidin, صلى الله على يا مولاي يا أبا محمد إمام زين العابدين was غريب as most of our imams were. People abandoned him. They left him. They didn't listen to him. In the city of the Prophet, he was alone. There's something about Medina. Take your hearts to Baqi. How many of you wish to be there these nights? I'm sure these nights, the grave of Imam Zain al-Abidin is lonely. No one's there visiting. No one's there reciting nohas. No one's there reciting salams. No one's there reciting marsiyas. Ya Allah, can we see a day that the Shia gather in Baqi, build a beautiful shrine connected to the Masjid of the Prophet? What a beautiful day that would be. But right now there's nothing but bare soil. Ya A'immati wa Sadati Ruhi Fidakum. There's something about Medina, there's so much loneliness and ghurba. Amirul Mu'mineen was gharib in Medina. Fatimatu Zahra was gharib. Imam al-Mujtaba was gharib. Imam Zain al-Abidin, Imam al-Baqir, Imam al-Sadiq, Ruhi fidakum. Imam Zain al-Abidin survived Karbala, but his soul was torn to pieces, knowing of what happened in Karbala, seeing what happened in Karbala, hearing Hal min Nasirin Yansurni, hearing Imam al-Husayn call out when he's all alone, Hal min Nasirin Yansurni. Imagine Imam Zain al-Abidin hearing that. He tries to get up, he tries to grab a sword, but his body just cannot do that, cannot respond. Ya Mazloom. When he watched his aunt Zainab protect the children, he saw her. She would put herself between the men and the children. They would be whipping her. Imam Zain al-Abidin would be seeing that. I'm supposed to be protecting you all, but I can't. Ruhi fidak ya Mawlai. No wonder they say in Medina, plenty of times, different occasions, different scenarios, Imam Zain al-Abidin constantly remembered Karbala. If he would see they're about to slaughter a lamb, he would say, wait, have you given the lamb water? They said, of course we did, we are Muslimun. He said, well, they slaughtered my father without giving him water.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio. for those who seek the truth.
Seven, they're under pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. There's one particular individual who kept the message and the mission of Karbala alive. It was her job, it was her duty. It was the reason, or rather, not the reason, but one of the main reasons that she was taken with the caravan to Karbala. It was the reason why, according to some narrations, or some historical narrations, I'm not prophetic, some historical descriptions that we have, that when she got married, she made the condition that when Hussein alayhi salam goes, you cannot stop me. I have to go with him. That's the condition she gave to her husband, Abdullah. So this lady, who we all know is Lady Zainab, salamullah alayha, was the pinnacle and the apex, and rather the true standard bearer of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam after the event of Karbala. She stood up to all the oppressors throughout the lands, in Kufa to Ibn Ziyad, in Damascus or Sham to Yazid, to Medina. She stood up and she continued the mission, such there came a time where the people and the governor and the government could not control anymore, could not hold, could not bear her anymore. That she was then, according to some narrations, exiled from Medina towards either Egypt or to Sham. Again, there's a difference of opinions in historical narrations. So this lady, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala make us of the servants of this lady, inshallah, the daughter of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the daughter of Zahra, salamullah alayha. What else do you expect? What else do we expect? May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala make us of those who truly understand the status of Zainab, salamullah alayha. So anyway, inshallah, the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners is one that is based on her life, inshallah. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. So as I mentioned in our previous segment, the book that we would like to mention today is titled Lady Zainab. Now, this book has been compiled by Brother Badr Shahin. It was then published by Ansarian Publications, which is situated in the holy city of Qom in the Islamic Republic of Iran. This book was first published in the year 2002, and then a second reprint was published in the year 2006. So this book basically goes through the life of Bibi Zainab, salamullah alayha. It begins with the life of Bibi Zainab, her lineage, her blessed birth, her monikers or epithets, that is her nicknames that she was given, and the reason that she was given that, and the meanings of those things, like Al-Aqila, Al-Alima, As-Sadiqa, As-Sughra, Ummul Musa'ib, and so on and so forth, the year of her birth, her early life, her scholarly capabilities, for example, being in Kufa, people asking her questions, being in learning from who, her father, her mother, her brothers, and so on. Her marriage, her personality traits, such as her faith, her dignity, her courage. And it goes on and on, for example. Then he goes into the time of the Khalifs, when the three Khalifs was the position and the kind of things that Bibi Zainab salamullah alayha at that time, in that era, what history tells us that she did and was involved in. Then after the time of the Khalifat or the reign of Imam Ali alayhi salam, during the time of Imam Ali's reign in Kufa, what did she do? After, what did she do when she was Imam Hassan alayhi salam, when she was what, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, especially the time when Imam alayhi salam wanted to leave Medina, wanted to first leave Mecca and go to Medina, or rather leave Medina and go to Mecca, and then from Mecca travel towards Karbala, which the Imam obviously, as we know, left in the month of Rajab. So she was there from the very beginning of the Imam's journey, from Medina to Mecca, from Mecca then towards Karbala, rather first towards Kufa, and on the way being stopped in Karbala, in a land called Karbala, and that would happened. So inshallah, in our next segment, we will want to read a small segment of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Başının kani zelfinde hana
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasir Ibrahim. So the book that we mentioned today, the title of the book that we would like to mention today is titled Lady Zainab. It was compiled by Brother Badr Shahin and was published by Ansarin Publications, which is located in the city of Qom in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So the section that we would like to read for our dear listeners is titled Back to Medina, which is on page 214 of this book. So back to Medina. Obviously, back to Medina, meaning after Bibi Zainab salamullah alayha went to Kufa, went to Sham, went back to Karbala, according to some narrations, and then back to Medina. So the whole journey. Having seen the influential results of the addresses of Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam and Lady Zainab salamullah alayha, Yazid anticipated a rebel or at least a disorder in the capital of his state. He therefore decided to send the Prophet's family away from Damascus to their hometown, Medina. He gathered them in his palace and poured very much money on a silky carpet as blood money for the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein, his household, and his companions. This situation infuriated the ladies so terribly that they all spoke. Lady Zainab said, "You are surely shameless and boastful. You kill my brother and family members, and then you want me to accept money as a recompense?" Lady Sukeena, salamullah alayha, said, "I have never seen such hard-heartedness. I have never seen an infidel and polytheist more vicious than you." And so on, they continued. Hence the tyrant who thought that the Ahlul Bayt can be submitted by matter. Hence the tyrant who thought that the Ahlul Bayt can be submitted by money or any other transient material failed to subjugate the Prophet's household, since he did not believe that the Almighty Allah only desires to keep away the uncleanliness for them and to purify them, a thorough purifying. He then ordered Al-Nu'man ibn Bashir to accompany the Prophet's family to Medina, having this journey, and to take care of them along this journey. He also decided to begin that journey at night so as to evade any expected disorder or revolt. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to truly give us the understanding of Ashura of Karbala, to make us of those who truly respect it and respect the book, and to make us of the true soldier of Imam al-Sahib al-Asr al-Zaman, inshaAllah. Until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasir Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
Midstream.
Have passed with its torments, oppression, and tragedies, while the families of the victims of the Beirut port explosion still taste the absence of justice. Since August 4, 2020, the families of the victims feel that the hands of their clocks stopped at 6:07 p.m. This is the time when the lives of loved ones, relatives, and friends were wasted. The explosion did not stir a finger in the Lebanese state, despite the protest movements and the continuous demonstrations of the families of the victims and the accompanying raids on the homes of politicians and officials suspected of their involvement or their complicity in obstructing the implementation of judicial decisions. In a statement, the Association of the Families of the Victims of the Beirut Port Explosion reminded of 235 victims and thousands of injured and disabled people as a result of the explosion, stressing that there is no condolence for the families, no rest for the souls of the victims, except with knowledge of the truth and accountability. The investigation into the port explosion, which began in August 2020, has been stalled since December 2021. Investigating Judge Tariq Bitar, who tried to resume his investigations in January 2023, is banned from traveling today and is himself under investigation. And in light of the prevention of taking the necessary legal measures, there are no answers in the horizon. Given the enormity of the Beirut port disaster, one of the most powerful non-nuclear explosions in history, this delay in achieving justice and accountability in Lebanon increases the suffering of the victims' families, who have the right to know what happened and who bears responsibility for this calamity. The absence of transparency and accountability is not in the interest of Lebanon, and this means that lessons were not learned and those responsible for what happened were not punished. Yet, in the midst of all this confusion, something suspicious is going on. Taking advantage of the obstruction in the judicial process and continuous foreign interference in Lebanon, U.S. proxies in Lebanon, along with many European embassies, have called on the authorities to place relevant documents and files related to the explosion at the disposal of external investigations. More than 30 countries, along with Samir Jaja's coalition of political blocs in Lebanon, have submitted a joint statement before the Human Rights Council expressing their so-called concern and frustration over the failure to complete the Lebanese investigation and have urged Lebanon to reside to an international investigation. Been there, done that. This will only bring more disaster and fracture to the Lebanese political scene and possibly increase security threats. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. After the Beirut port explosion, which killed more than 235 people and injured 7,000, the investigation file on the accident is still forgotten and faces several obstacles, mainly related to the political crisis in the country. The explosion, whose third anniversary fell on Friday, August 4th, has essentially exacerbated the economic crisis, whose features had begun about a year before the blast and accelerated after it, to a point that 80% of the population are living below the poverty line. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashabi, expert in human rights law and editor-in-chief of the Al-Qaws magazine, which is a weekly supplement devoted to justice and fairness issued by Beirut News Company. Thank you, Dr. Nashabi, for being with us now. The Lebanese regime, according to what political sources have been claiming, used judicial and political tools to undermine the investigation into the 2020 Beirut port explosion. That's just against all logic. Why would the Lebanese authority, or at least those who are currently right now in power, would want to see the investigation of the biggest non-nuclear blast in history being undermined?
Yes. Thank you for having me on the show. The investigation since the beginning was flawed. There was a problem with the investigation because the investigation did not move swiftly and quickly in order to depict all the information and actually survey the crime scene in a proper way. Also, the search and rescue efforts in the first week were very, very slow, and there were so many challenges and problems. Now, what happened later is that they changed the investigator because there was a political divide, and the judicial system in Lebanon, the judicial authority is not independent. And this is a crime where the explosion took place in the seaport, and the seaport is government property. It's the responsibility of the government. So logically, it's the government should investigate itself. And that's a challenge, especially in a country where you don't have an independent judiciary. So this is actually what happened in a nutshell, and it's ongoing now. This is a serious crisis because, every political group is accusing the other political group of being responsible of it, and there is a kind of a chaos when it comes to media. Also, there are so many leaks or what is claimed to be leaks that are all over the TVs and the media, and that is really inappropriate because the investigation is supposed to be confidential, whereas the trial is supposed to be public, whereas, apparently every political group with their media are publishing parts of documents and documents that they claim are authentic about the investigation, and we can't know if these documents are authentic or not, or what's happening. I mean, this requires a qualified independent judiciary, and this is what we don't have in Lebanon, unfortunately, at the time being. So the politicians are taking over, and the media is getting out stories as per convenience, and this is inappropriate. We're supposed to have a judicial authority that takes over and that works in a confidential way until the whole investigation is transferred to a court of law in order to have fair trial.
Well, Dr. Nashebi, we all know that we have a flawed system in the judicial system in Lebanon, but at the same time, you are seeing some suspicious behavior from some of the U.S. allies inside of Lebanon, along with more than 30 countries with their embassies in Lebanon, led by the Lebanese forces, once war criminal Samir Jaja, who sent a petition to the Human Rights Watch, along with officials, parliamentarians, diplomats, and representatives of humanitarian organizations. They all are pushing the Human Rights Council to form an international fact-finding committee into the Beirut port. Do they have a point there? And if not, then why not just push for a better Lebanese judiciary to take its role and put those accountable in their places?
Exactly. Well, you see, because there are so many divisions in Lebanon, and probably the viewers know these strong divisions and know the American interference in Lebanese affairs and the Israeli pressure also on European countries and Americans to actually create groups that are capable of countering Hezbollah and countering the resistance, so that in case the resistance, or when the resistance clashes with the Israelis, they could utilize some of the groups that they encourage in order to fight Hezbollah and hit him in the back. So this is known, and this is what the Israelis and the Europeans and the Americans are trying to do. And
what does that have to be with any fact-finding mission?
Well, this is good, because they are trying to say that this horrible crime, and they said it a few days ago, that there is a responsibility, a main responsibility for Hezbollah, and that the nitrate ammonium stored in the seaport belongs to Hezbollah. They're saying these claims without any evidence or any indication that is a serious indication. Why would Hezbollah store all this nitrate ammonium?
Despite the fact that we have spoken on this show before now,
yes,
last year to be exact, and we said where this shipment came from, who's the man
exactly
responsible, where his offices are
exactly
in the UK, which are registered in the UK government.
Yes.
So why all of a sudden calling for a fact-finding mission, an international one, to come to Lebanon? And who's going to pay for it?
Well, because they're taking advantage of the fact that the system, the judicial system, is flawed. They're taking advantage of the fact that there is no independent judiciary in Lebanon. That's true. But that doesn't mean automatically that we will go and call upon the international community or the United Nations to bring in a fact-finding mission. That will not help in reforming the judicial system and in fixing the problem. What they want to do is, and they've been calling for an international nationalization of disputes between the Lebanese. Although
it's like what we went through.
Exactly.
And it is the definition of madness because we know the results. And I mean, in your opinion, what if this is just another plot to politically target certain Lebanese groups and we are here all talking about the Lebanese resistance?
I think it's not really
What will happen to the country?
Yes, it's not really a plot. It's an attempt and a desperate attempt. And really, it doesn't work this way and it's not going to work because the international community, they did this before. And actually, they're asking the Human Rights Council to actually set up a fact-finding mission. If the Human Rights Council, first of all, who's going to pay for that? Will the Human Rights Council actually want to pay so much money? And then what's the fact-finding mission? How's it going to have to do? How's it going to be the relationship between the fact-finding mission and the Lebanese authorities? Do we undermine also Lebanese sovereignty? And after the report comes out, how is it going to be translated into something tangible where the actual guilty people are going to be held accountable? How is this going to work? I mean, this is all just a political slogan by a group of frustrated people who are taking advantage of the victims, taking advantage of the fact that the country is so saddened by this horrible crime, mm-hmm. and trying to use it in a very horrible way to serve a political program and to serve their political agenda, that is to side with the Western powers who are pressured by Israel in order to attack Hezbollah internally. And that is what they're doing. And amidst the economic crisis, the Europeans and the Americans, and perhaps some Gulf countries, are ready to pay a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, when you have such a economic crisis, this thing becomes attractive to many in Lebanon, unfortunately.
I do understand, and I think 9 or 8 minutes are not enough to analyze the situation, given the fact that we now know, because of the pushing of the U.S. and Israel, that they might actually have a hand in that, but that's another topic to discuss with you, Dr. Omar Nashebi, whether they do have a hand or not, or whether they took advantage of the Lebanese corruption, for that matter. Dr. Nashebi, expert in human rights law and editor-in-chief of the Al-Qaws magazine, thank you very much for being with us and discussing the anniversary of the third anniversary of the explosion of the port of Beirut. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned because next we will be talking about another man in Lebanon that brought the economy to its knees.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Over the years, he was the godfather of the stability of the Lebanese lira and the recovery of the economy after the Lebanese Civil War. And he won awards and was even honored at the U.S. Treasury. But the governor of the Banque du Liban, or the Lebanese Central Bank, Riyad Salameh, ended last week a tenure that lasted 4 decades. After pressure from wide segments of the Lebanese, European, and even local judicial investigations about his wealth and his performance, and amid an unprecedented economic collapse in the country. More details in this following report.
The epicenter of the financial earthquake is the Central Bank of Lebanon. Riyad Salameh has run the bank for 30 years, which makes it the longest period in the service of a central bank governor in the world. For most of that time, Salameh claimed to champion a stable and conservative philosophy of monetary policy. But behind the era of easy money was what the World Bank and heads of state, including French President Emmanuel Macron, have called a Ponzi scheme. As times became more difficult within the Lebanese state, the Bank of Lebanon began to struggle to pay its debts, and the country's commercial banks began to falter as well. To buy time, Salameh embarked on a few rounds of cheap credit, but he eventually came up with a more desperate solution, relying on the commercial banks themselves to fill holes in his cash reserves. When people started to feel the pain of the rising cost of living, that setup also stopped. The financial system collapsed in 2019, and the country stopped paying off foreign debt burdens.
Since late 2019, the Lebanese have been suffering from an unprecedented economic crisis, which led to a historic collapse in the value of the Lebanese lira and a sharp deterioration in the purchasing power of citizens, while banks continued the policy of withholding deposits and handing over parts of them to depositors according to circulars that depreciated the money's real value. All that happened at a time when the exchange rate of the dollar on the black market hit the barriers of 100,000 Lebanese lira. Today, the Lebanese economy is in shambles. Inflation exceeded 170% last year, and credit rating agencies say this year could be worse. Salemi left office end of July rather than seeking another six-year term. Before his planned retirement to his villa overlooking Beirut, his most loyal companion may be his Cohiba cigar. In May, French and German prosecutors issued arrest warrants for Salemi in connection with an investigation that has spanned six countries. The allegations include the purchase of real estate in those countries using millions of dollars of stolen Lebanese public funds. In Lebanon, however, Salemi remained remarkably untouched. He was free to smoke cigars in his office while the vanishing middle class was left to desperately consider its options. For 2 years, Salemi's wealth has been the focus of investigations in Lebanon and Europe. The man who won regional and international awards and accolades of honor in recognition of his efforts in office and was the first Arab Central Bank governor to have the opening bell of the New York Stock Exchange ring for him insists that he accumulated his wealth from his previous work for 2 decades in the global financial institution Merrill Lynch and from investments in several fields far from his work as the head of the governorship of Lebanon's central bank. With political cover, Salemi has been involved since 2016 in financial engineering aimed at preserving the value of the Lebanese lira, raising the central bank's reserves and capitalizing banks. But economists consider it among the main reasons that contributed to the deepening of the country's financial crisis. With the onset of a liquidity scarcity crisis and banks imposing strict restrictions on withdrawing deposits, especially in U.S. dollars, in the fall of 2019, Riyad Salemi insisted in the first month that the Lebanese lira is fine. Today, more than 3 years after a collapse that the World Bank ranked among the worst in the world since 1850, the local currency has lost more than 98% of its value against the U.S. dollar. Despite the criticisms that affected his performance and the suspicions that persecuted him in London and abroad, Salemi remained in his position. Some believe that he was aspiring to be a candidate for the presidency of the republic, which justifies him not rejecting any request from the political class. Despite the investigations that began affecting him 2 years ago, Salemi insisted on remaining in his position until the last moment. European investigators suspect that he illegally accumulated real estate and banking assets and that he misused public funds on a large scale during his tenure as governor of the Lebanese Central Bank. Based on the investigations, a French judge in Paris and the public prosecutor in Munich issued 2 arrest warrants against Salemi, which were circulated through Interpol. But Salemi rejected the charges against him, deeming them falsified statements based on political grounds. Only one thing is certain, and that is that the exit of Riyad Salemi from the top position in the central bank will not be the end of the economic crisis in Lebanon. With no one named after him and no real solutions on the horizon, public anger towards Lebanon's banks will merely continue to grow.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ghassan Jawad, writer and politician, head of the Lebanese Group for Media and Political Studies and the owner and editor-in-chief of the digital newspaper Beirut Press. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ghassan. Now, the governor of the Central Bank of Lebanon, Riyad Salemi, stepped down after 30 years in office, but he is leaving behind an economy in shambles and a country experiencing one of the worst financial crises in the world. But is that it? Just Riyad Salemi leaves without any accountability?
Unfortunately, this scene that appeared during Riyad Salemi's escape from the central bank building is a provocative and disturbing scene for many Lebanese, especially the Lebanese whose deposits were suspended in the banks. So I don't think him leaving means it's over. Riyad Salemi is attached to judicial files inside and outside Lebanon. Of course, He enjoys political protections that allowed him to go out without accountability today. But these political protections, with the passage of time, will diminish and weaken their ability to protect Riyad Salami. And therefore, sooner or later, we will see Riyad Salami a subject of serious trials. Therefore, we demand, as we demanded previously, that the trial be national in the national judiciary, rather than allowing Lebanon to be subjected to more international judicial permissibility. But if he